You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming on the show today. We have a very special guest. I have a very special guest. The gentleman that I'm going to introduce to you is a noted author and a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, and he's considered one of the world's leading experts on economic warfare and financial terrorism. He wrote a special report for the Department of Defense uncovering the deliberate attacks that took place on the U.S. financial, during the U.S. financial collapse of 2008. And he, based on that report, he wrote a book called Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And he is a frequent speaker around the country. I heard him speak just recently at a group here in Dallas. And in fact, he and I both belong to the group. And then he has spoken around the country on this issue and others. He has also been on CNN and Fox Business and a number of radio talk shows. And so we're honored to have him here. His name is Kevin Freeman. And I'm sitting here looking at his most recent book, which everybody needs to buy a copy of immediately, because I just finished reading it. And I'm not sure it's in the right genre. I think it ought to be under horror books, but it'll scare you half to death, but it also provides you extremely valuable information on how to protect yourself from the coming cyber economic attack. So Kevin Freeman is my guest. Kevin, good to have you on.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Why don't you give my listening audience a little more of your background. How did you get involved in this specific issues?
Well, my primary background is investment management. I've been involved in political issues my whole life. My father is very active in Oklahoma. He's a lover of the Constitution, and in fact, he was one of the trainers and the Oklahoma director for the National Center for Constitutional Studies. And so, you know, my whole life I've grown up with it. I recently heard Rafael Cruz talking about his son Ted and how his son had built a love for the Constitution early on. And I saw a lot of parallels. Ted's younger than I am and far more successful, but I like the fact that both of our parents indoctrinated us with a love for the Constitution. And how I got involved specifically in this is I was doing investment management. When I went to work for Templeton, we started a division from scratch and ended up managing about $2.5 billion. And I left there in the year 2000. And started my own firm about 2006. And in 2008, when the stock market started to collapse, I knew there was something very different. I had experience of 25 years at that point in the investment markets. My father had experience closer to 50 years. Neither of us had seen what was taking place. So I dug down beneath it and, at the request of the Pentagon, actually did a formal study that proved pretty conclusively that while we were worried about a housing bubble, and that was real, and regulatory problems, and those were real, our enemies were literally taking steps, measures to destroy our economy, using our own economy as its own weapon. And the perfect example of that is the former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson admitted that during the Summer Olympics, the Russians approached the Chinese and said, let's work together to undermine the American economy. We'll dump all our holdings of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We'll throw them into bankruptcy. America will collapse, and Russia and China can take over leadership of the global economy. And fortunately, the Chinese didn't join. Just imagine how bad things would have gotten if China had joined Russia. But Russia went ahead and did what the BBC recently called a bear raid against our economy. That was an intended attack, trying to make all of us poor and break the dollar and break our ability to save, invest, and build in this country.
Well, Bart, we are vulnerable to that again, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Vladimir Putin is threatening that even now. He says he moves into Crimea and says, if you retaliate in any way seriously, I will crash the dollar, I will hack your stock market and cause it to crash, You know, America will end up completely broke if you pursue this. We will bust your financial system. And it wasn't just bluster. He sent out Sergei Glazyev, one of his senior advisors, who made it very clear that that's the stated intention. And then he got backing. He didn't get backing in 2008, but this year he's gotten backing from China, saying that we stand with Russia on these issues. So it's a very serious threat, and it's one that, unfortunately, our administration has not taken seriously.
Well, this is a question I know a lot of people are thinking right now, and that is, why would China want to bring down the U.S. economy since they are our major creditor? We owe them so much money.
You know, and we did war games on this in 2009. When I wrote my report, it got to the Pentagon, and they actually war gamed it out. And what we found was that China doesn't take sides. They just don't join in attacking Russia. And by not taking sides on this, China ends up the stronger. They're able to play both sides of the street. We don't retaliate against China. We retaliate against Russia, but they get strengthened through it. Now, let me be clear. China has serious economic difficulties, and they would be harmed measurably if our economy went down. But there are elements in China who have not just a five-year outlook, which is their minimum. That's like we look at a quarter out, they look 5 years out, but they have 25-year, quarter century, and century-long views that suggest that if America goes down, it will hurt China, but in the long run, they'll win. Fortunately, there are elements in China that don't want to see America collapse, and we have good friends in the business community and some in the government. But there are clearly enemies in the People's Liberation Army, some in the government, and some in the business community. So bottom line is the war game found that China, just by agreeing to not punish Russia, not to join in any sanctions against Russia, and playing both sides of the street using cyber espionage and so forth, they can win from our harm if they have a long enough viewpoint.
Well, what type of attacks are the Russians looking at making now? Similar to what I assume what happened in 2008, but are there other elements involved?
Well, they're much more sophisticated elements now. In 2008, they just dumped holdings of Fannie and Freddie, and the attack that I wrote about in Secret Weapon included a bear raid, which is a purposed attack on a company using the stock market against Lehman Brothers. And that didn't emanate from Russia. That came out of the Middle East. But there were elements in the Middle East that decided that Lehman Brothers was vulnerable, and they would profit from it and push it as far and as fast as they could to break it. And those weapons are still available. One of those is called naked short selling, which is really sounds obscure. It's not sitting at your E-Trade account in your underwear playing with stock market, but it is literally putting in sell orders in the market for something you don't own, haven't borrowed, have no intention of borrowing. And so, for example, when Lehman Brothers was struggling and their stock started going down, just imagine somebody who didn't have any shares calling up and selling 100 million shares of Lehman Brothers. And that's how many were sold naked. That means they weren't covered. That means nobody owned them. During the week of September 11th, 2008, 100 million shares of Lehman were sold and never delivered. It's called a failure to deliver trade. But it's illegal for the most part, but it still has the net effect of creating panic on Wall Street, making it impossible for Lehman to recover like Bear Stearns did. We had two major failures in 2008, two very serious failures. One was Bear Stearns in February, and it got gobbled up by J.P. Morgan Chase. They just bought them outright. They paid a fraction of what the share was worth and closed out. Lehman was not bought out because of all this naked short selling, and in fact what happened is the buyout scheduled by Barclays never took place, and so Lehman went bankrupt. And according to George Soros and many others, when Lehman went bankrupt, that's when the whole system started to fail. That's why we're still recovering today. That's why unemployment is still as high as it is. It was Lehman's failure was the last crack in that system and allowed it to collapse. And it's taken trillions of dollars to shore up the system in response. But your question was, what weapons are available? That weapon is still available, but the new weapon is cyber. And when we see the Heartbleed virus and realize that we didn't notice it for 2 years operating and making us vulnerable, we've got to understand that our NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, most of the major big brokerage firms, most of the banks have all been hacked at one time or another. And it is something that could take place in an instant where that virus that was planted 2 or 3 years ago is turned on and all of the data is wiped out. And no one knows who owns what, where, when, or how. That's the kind of attack that we're looking at. And the conclusion of General Keith Alexander, of the former head of the NSA and Cyber Command, is absolutely nation states, and Russia has to be among them, have the capability to completely wipe out our financial system.
You said something that rang a bell in my head, being a former military intelligence officer. September 11, 2008, that's when the attack took place from the Middle East. And, of course, the number 11, is they're very fond of that in the terrorist community, the Middle Eastern terrorist community. I don't know what the number means to them exactly. I've been told, but I can't recall it at the moment. But, of course, the attack on the World Trade Center was September 11th also. So who in the Middle East has the capabilities to do this, and do you know who did it in 2008?
Well, we have a good idea that the sovereign wealth fund in two nations, Abu Dhabi and Qatar, were involved in the ownership of Barclays, and Barclays was the one scheduled to bail out Lehman that turned it down. And we have traced back some of the trading that looks like it goes back to those two sovereign wealth funds. And the head of one of them, from a Sharia compliance perspective, is probably the senior most cleric of the Muslim Brotherhood, a guy named Karwadawi. And we know that he determined what investments that the sovereign wealth fund could make or not make based on his position. We also know that he is not welcomed in the United States, and he's not welcomed in Egypt as the senior most cleric and the senior scholar for the Muslim Brothers. And we also know that on his TV show that's broadcast in the Middle East on Al Jazeera, that he regularly makes disparaging comments about the United States, about our financial system, and says that Sharia finance has to replace capitalism. That's the mandate of Allah, and he intends to see it happen. And we also know that Lehman was a Jewish, owned to large extent, Jewish-founded investment bank, and there was a lot of cackling in the Middle East to see it fail because it was based on forbidden interest and so forth. So we believe, we suspect that somehow all of that's tied up. And I put all that evidence in my first book, Secret Weapon, that those groups felt like the failure of Lehman would be a good thing because it would help bring down capitalism, it would harm a Jewish bank, and at the same time it would usher in a profit for the Sharia compliant fund.
All right, well, let's take our first break now, Kevin, and then I won't have, needless to say, have many more questions for you.
Great.
The United States Justice Foundation, since 1979, has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear?
All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Who is or what is USJF? It is a nonprofit legal organization founded to protect our rights through the U.S. Constitution. Active in educating the public, USJF has also contributed directly and indirectly to legal defense efforts in many celebrated cases involving fundamental conservative principles. Cases of note include the Mount Soledad Cross case, the Arizona immigration law case, the Obama eligibility cases, the NDAA illegal detention issue, and many more. Help this nonprofit as they help you. Visit www.usjf.net today.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone. My guest today is Kevin Freeman, a good friend and somebody I admire greatly because of what he's capable of doing and what he knows. He's written a book called Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Took Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And he's also written a book recently called Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And Kevin, before the break, you had mentioned something called Sharia compliance as far as the economic warfare goes. I am vaguely familiar with that. I'm familiar with Sharia law because that's one of the areas that we work with at the United States Justice Foundation, trying to prevent the American courts and the Congress from giving in to Sharia law. But when it comes to economics, what exactly is Sharia compliant mean?
Yeah, that's a great question, Michael. With the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they came up with a series of practical applications for Sharia law, one of which is that if interest is forbidden, you're not to receive interest nor should you pay interest, then you need to have a finance mechanism that would allow you to buy a home, for example. If you can't pay interest, how do you buy a home with a mortgage when the interest rate will be required? So they created this workaround called Sharia-compliant finance. And the workaround is that the Sharia-compliant finance company will buy the house that you want to own for you, and then they will sell it to you in equal monthly installments that do not contain interest, but instead, so you buy a house for $200,000, and they decide that the value of the house at the end of 30 years is going to be $400,000. So they start to sell you that house, and they divide $400,000 by your 30 years, and you make the payments. And just interestingly, the calculations tend to work out to where they're just about exactly as they would be if you'd paid interest, but you have that whole issue washed out, and that's Sharia-compliant finance. Then they created, they said, well, you know, we ought to be making investments like this. And so they had a scholar that determines what is an acceptable investment. Can you invest in this company or can you invest in that company? And can you buy bonds? How do you do that? And so the scholar determines what's acceptable. And in 2007, in August, there was a Wall Street Journal article that says something to the effect of when Islamic finance meets Wall Street. And they were debating what it would be like to short sell securities. And they even talk about the idea of short selling banks because banks violate Islamic law because they give and receive interest, riba. And so they were talking about maybe we could begin short selling using this concept. All they needed was the Sharia scholar to bless the concept. And the Sharia scholar in this case is Karwadawi, perhaps the senior most Muslim Brother scholar, as we've mentioned, and they came up with a formula with which you could literally sell short. And traditionally, when you sell short, you borrow shares from someone, and you sell them on the open market, and then when the price goes down, you hope, you buy those shares back, you return the loan of the shares that you'd borrowed, and you keep any profit or you accept any loss that you've had. So you borrow shares, sell them, and later buy them back and return what you borrowed. That's traditional short selling. Problem there is when you borrow something, you pay interest on it, and that would be forbidden. And so the mechanism was set up to where they could just sell without borrowing. It's called naked short selling. It's mostly illegal, but it seems that as if there was an exemption granted, as far as we can tell, to allow them to do this, and that then got abused to the extent that 100 million shares of Lehman Brothers were naked short sold by sovereign wealth funds that were Sharia compliant, by hedge funds that were anti-Lehman Brothers, by broker-dealers like Bernie Madoff was famous for naked short selling. So, in fact, they even made the exemption to the rule that says it was illegal. They called it the Madoff exemption. That's how connected he was to it. And so these entities all ganged up. Lehman Brothers, which was already wounded, was put out of its misery into bankruptcy. And somebody profited very substantially from those 100 million shares. If you imagine they made $40 on the downside, which was quite possible because Lehman dropped very sharply, 100 million shares, $40 to the downside would be $4 billion worth of profit. And that's about how much Barclays took out of Lehman when they bought the assets in bankruptcy. They didn't rescue them. They bought the assets out of bankruptcy for about $1 billion, marked it up to $5 billion and within a couple of months, and then closed out those positions. So somebody made $4 billion off Lehman's demise, and the rest of us went broke in the process.
Who would have granted the exemption to them that you mentioned?
Well, the SEC granted the Madoff exemption. And Bernie Madoff was the head of the National Association of Securities Dealers. We didn't know it at the time. I guess a few people who looked at his book could tell he was a fraud, but the SEC wasn't admitting he was a fraud. And he approached them and said, could you allow us to naked short sell, even if for a brief period, to add liquidity to the marketplace? And the SEC agreed, and then later in a Forbes interview, He boasted no one ever caught on to his crime of literally selling fake shares of companies and never going back and buying them or borrowing them. He called it his crime of staying naked short. So it was the SEC that ignored Madoff's problems. It was the SEC, and I'm not the one who says the SEC was ignoring the naked short selling. That was actually the Inspector General of the Securities Exchange Commission at the time, a man named David Kotz, who said that the SEC completely overlooked this, and he went on to admit that it could be used by terrorists to destabilize our financial market. And that got picked up, based on my research, by The Economist magazine. So, this isn't some conspiracy theory. This is validated Pentagon research that was validated by a report from the Inspector General of the SEC, and later acknowledged in The Economist magazine, which is it's a highly respected publication out of London. And all of this took place with most of America completely ignorant that they were this vulnerable, that this back door to our system was left in and exploited and otherwise illegal back door, but granted exemptions that nearly destroyed us all financially.
Well, I talk sometimes about the Muslim Brotherhood on this show and how dangerous it is, and the fact that they've already got people in the U.S. government that are connected with the Muslim Brotherhood appointed by Obama. But explain to our listeners how strong the Muslim Brotherhood is and how they are basically funders of terrorist networks out there.
Well, here's some facts about the Muslim Brotherhood. They're disparate facts, but they tell an interesting story. It was founded in Egypt and made illegal for most of the time in Egypt. It was banned as a political party because their stated intent is to put Sharia law around the world. And it was Nasser had banned it, and then he was killed, and Mubarak banned it in Egypt. But it established in other parts of the world, and it's actually in the United States that recently announced they're going to form a political party of the Muslim Brotherhood. We know that they were listed in the Holy Land Foundation trial as an unindicted co-conspirator, and they've been connected to multiple terrorist groups. Now, we also know that the current director of national intelligence at one time was testifying before Congress and was questioned about the Muslim Brotherhood, and his response was that they were largely a secular group because they have an offshoot that does charitable work. We also know that in Egypt, when the Arab Spring took place, that the Muslim Brotherhood was a key instigator in the overthrow of Mubarak, and that they formed the new government. They were the elected new government that the military had to remove. We also know that the Muslim Brotherhood has stated desires to overthrow other Arab regimes, and that they have stated desires, as I said, to implement Sharia law. So the DNI, who is also, by the way, the same guy that said that NSA wasn't collecting information, and then he later said, well, I misunderstood the question, or I couldn't answer it without revealing classified information. That DNI says that they're a largely secular group, and we've noticed that the administration has certainly not been hard on the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, they were very supportive of the government in Egypt and called out the Egyptian military for removing them. But the Muslim Brotherhood is a very, in my view, a very dedicated sect intent on removing the Constitution of the United States and replacing it with Sharia. They have, in most cases, operated in peaceful ways, in trying to get elected, and there is evidence that they've been involved in other ways. And Al Jazeera and Al-Wardawi are prime examples of the thinking of the leadership. So it's a group that we need to be, I think, very concerned about. And they have been very successful at times around the world in their stated objectives. There are documents that have been found that have been linked to them where they've said that they're going to sabotage our miserable house within, that we're going to they're going to set us up to where we destroy ourselves. So it is a group that the Egyptian military would consider to be highly subversive. And, if you keep that in mind, then you have a good idea of who they are and what their stated intention might be.
So for those people out there who don't know about the Holy Land Foundation trial, of course, that took place right here in Dallas. And I was aware of it and kept up with it because of the impact on the United States and also the Sharia law aspects of it, because that was basically a defense that they were trying to use in the case. And the Muslim Brotherhood was indicted unindicted co-conspirator in the thing. And the whole trial basically was about the Holy Land Foundation raising money in this country and then funneling that money to terrorist organizations out there. And so we're looking at a definite terrorist link here to the Muslim Brotherhood. And as Kevin just said, we're talking about a group that, I hadn't heard about them forming a political party. It doesn't surprise me in most respects. However, I am a little surprised they think they need a political party when they have the Democratic Party in their pocket, apparently, or it seems to be that way. But we'll take another break at this point, Kevin, and then we'll talk some more.
Great.
Who is or what is USJF? It is a nonprofit legal organization founded to protect our rights through the U.S. Constitution. Active in educating the public, USJF has also contributed directly and indirectly to legal defense efforts in many celebrated cases involving fundamental conservative principles. Cases of note include the Mount Soledad Cross case, the Arizona Immigration Law case, the Obama eligibility cases, the NDAA illegal detention issue, and many more. Help this nonprofit as they help you. Visit www.usjf.net today.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
David?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay, something happened. I just got kicked off all of a sudden, and not sure what happened. There was a buzzing, and then the phone went off. But anyway, back to my guest, Kevin Freeman. Kevin, there's a lot more we need to talk about today. I wish, you know, we had a couple hours. But one of the things you talk about in your book, and in both books, actually, but one of the things I found most fascinating when you talked about it in the speech I heard you give recently is the cyber aspects of this. Now, you touched on it a little bit in the first segment, but talk more about how vulnerable we are to cyber attacks and what exactly would happen if, in fact, there was a cyber attack, for example, that took down our banking system.
Well, there are cyber attacks every day that take place, 10 million or so plus a day. There are cyber dedicated units in Iran and in North Korea. And in Iran, we know this because the Supreme Leader has actually shown footage on the Fars News Agency of all of the glorious warriors that are serving Allah and Iran as cyber hackers. And North Korea has developed very sophisticated cyber units, and this was admitted to by the Pentagon just recently in a Bill Gertz column that I put on my blog. And then Al-Qaeda has been out in the marketplace hiring the best hackers they can find from Russia and elsewhere. The People's Liberation Army in China has a very elite hacker unit that Mandiant has identified as hacking major systems, as has, of course, Russia. With Iran in particular, they made a public statement they were going to attack and hack banks, and they used denial-of-service attacks to force bank websites off. And that's a minor annoyance. I mean, it's a serious problem if you go on to your website and can't log on. But it's a really a minor annoyance in the grand scheme of things. But what happens if they're able to put something in that wipes out all the data? And there was a time in the past year where people logged on to a major bank, I believe it was Chase, and it showed their accounts were all empty. And it was a mistake. They hadn't populated the data. But it shows how dependent we are. What if the ATM machine stopped working and a hacking attempt could accomplish that? What if you couldn't get information on your holdings? What if someone hacked the trading algorithms at a big firm like Goldman Sachs to where they caused the Goldman Sachs traders to just go nuts selling and crash the market? We are extremely vulnerable to cyber attacks because we're so dependent on the Internet in the United States. And there's a picture that Don Rumsfeld used to show comparing South Korea and North Korea at night, and South Korea is all lit, and North Korea is very dark. And that's a telling story of the benefits of capitalism. But I turned that same thought around and said, you know, if there were an attack on the electric grid in South Korea, it would be devastating. But if the electric grid went down in North Korea, most of society would continue to function. Likewise, the United States is so dependent on the internet for absolutely everything that we do. If there's a cyber attack that takes out a bank, people wouldn't have money. They wouldn't be able to pay bills. They wouldn't be able to get money to buy food or pay their rent or mortgage or anything else. So we're extremely vulnerable, and it is entirely feasible that something could be put in that could cause mass chaos. Hopefully, we're resilient enough that we're backed up. I've argued that we need a reset button. We need to have a national mandate that says that if something goes wrong, that we have the ability to reboot and reset the system completely. And the problem is there's no overarching authority to determine how that would be done. And what we would do. The joke that we say is, oh, don't worry about it, NSA has copies of everything. But it is kind of frightening to imagine that a foreign power could literally take down our stock exchange, our banking system, to where we would be completely in the dark financially. So that is perhaps one of the most serious risks, and people say, what can we do about it? And I give one practical piece of advice on almost every interview, is just make sure you have paper copies of things. Don't rely exclusively on, you know, they'll offer you $50 or $5 or whatever if you'll just take electronic statements. Don't rely exclusively on electronic statements. And if you have relied on them and you've already taken the offer, print out a copy. Every month when you get your bank statement sent to you, print out a copy and keep it, because there may come a time where that's the only record you have. And I have a real-life personal example of that. I had a line of credit that was held at a bank that officed in the World Trade Center. And after the September 11th attack, there were no phones being answered. There was no internet access available. The company came back. It was a division of a larger company, and they did have backups. But that week after, I needed to make payroll, and I needed $50,000. I had more than enough in my credit line there to cover it, but all I had were my paper statements and paper checks. And I had to go to a bank here locally, and I had to literally beg them to take this check so I could make my payroll that week. And finally, because I had the paper copies of the statements, I could demonstrate that the money was there. I'd not used it. They argued with me for a while, but they went ahead and said, well, we need to keep the system operating. And because of courageous people like that, 9/11 did not totally destroy our economy. We did bounce back. But it only worked because I had paper copies of those statements.
Well, that's certainly good advice. But, you know, I've talked to some bankers about this situation, and they're also concerned about the fact that even if you have paper copies, so much of our currency does not really exist. It's not backed up by, we know it's not backed up by gold. It's not even backed up by the amount of paper money that would be needed. Banks don't have enough assets on hand, as I understand it, that if a bunch of people came in and had their paper copies and wanted to withdraw some money, the money would not be there, and the banks wouldn't be able to access it. Isn't that true?
No, there's truth in that, and I cover that in the book Game Plan. There's not enough money in the system, and there's not enough at the FDIC to back up the amount that is insured. And so it could cause enormous pain and chaos. But you're better off, assuming that people don't want to take all their money out, but they want to take out a normal amount to do their business and life and operations, having electronic copies is a problem, and having paper copies is a benefit. But it won't solve the problem ultimately. If there's something that takes the whole system down, you're going to need some alternatives. And I talk about those in the book Game Plan.
Well, you also talked in the speech that I heard you make, and you talked in your books about it. And explain to the listeners what an EMP attack is and what kind of chaos that would cause.
EMP attack is perhaps the single greatest economic weapon. The science for it is real. We found in low-altitude nuclear testing, we found that we would set off, or high-altitude nuclear testing, we would set off a nuclear weapon in the stratosphere, And we felt reasonably safe that it was not going to cause a radiation problem, and in fact it didn't. What it did cause was power went out anywhere that was in a line of sight to that explosion. And basically it wiped out the electric grid in small islands where we were testing. What we learned from that is that a nuclear explosion sends off a pulse of energy that is so powerful that it's like a surge, and we put surge protectors on our computers, but it just overwhelms standard surge protectors, and literally it'd wipe out transformers that send the power along the grid. We developed weapons, and Russia and China developed weapons, and North Korea has them, and the Iranians probably do, that could literally take down a power grid by setting off an EMP and wipe out computer databases, but it left buildings standing and people still alive. So it's like the next step beyond the neutron bomb developed in the 70s, which was the radiation would kill people, but there wouldn't be all that much destruction of property. This would be no radiation. It would just take down the power grid. Now, why is that so important? Is we're completely dependent on it. We need it to operate ATMs and traffic dispatching networks. We need it to operate water pumps so that our water supply. We need it to deliver food. We need it for just about every function of society. We need it for medicine, treatments. We need it for everything. So the EMP commission that was mandated by Congress determined that if we had a wide-scale, nationwide power outage, and it lasted any length of time, 6 months or a year or longer, that it had the possibility of eliminating maybe as much as 90% of the American population. People would die because they couldn't get food or water or medicines. We don't grow our own food anymore. We all live or most of us live in cities. And so we don't have the ability to sustain ourselves without modern conveniences, and those modern conveniences do not exist with an EMP. It would wipe out transformers that we don't even make and could take 2 to 3 years to replace, even if we're replacing just a few of them. 9 power substations out of thousands could, at a critical moment, take down the entire grid and make it impossible to restart. And I say that acknowledging that about a year ago, April 13th, I think it was, there was a power station substation outside Silicon Valley that less than a dozen terrorists broke into and shot up with submachine guns with the intent of destroying its provision of power to the Silicon Valley. And they came remarkably close to blacking out the Silicon Valley, and they certainly ruined the power substation. You know, just imagine taking out just a handful of those, and you've literally wiped out the grid. An EMP would take almost all of them out all at once. And here's the even scarier part. Even if a terrorist did not shoot a missile over the continental United States with a nuclear weapon that caused an EMP, a natural EMP could happen just from the sun sending out a coronal mass ejection of the right intensity at the right angle at the right time. And we had one of those happen in 1859. It was called a Carrington event, named after the amateur astronomer that noticed it. And it started burning up telegraph offices. If that same kind of event happened today, it could wipe down our power grid also. And we've done virtually nothing to protect against any of these situations. In fact, there was an article, I think it came out.
Take our final break now, Kevin, and then I want you to continue with that train of thought.
Okay.
The United States Justice Foundation since 1979 has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the final segment, ladies and gentlemen. Again, today my guest is Kevin Freeman, a good friend and author who has written several books, and the most recent being Game Plan, which is the one I just finished reading. It's How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And Kevin, before the break, you were explaining to us about the ways to possibly protect the power grid from the EMP attack.
Yes, and in fact, there was an LA Times article that is April 7th, so it's just a little over a week old, titled, Security Holes in Power Grid Have Federal Officials Scrambling. In Congress, the vulnerability of the power grid has emerged as among the most pressing domestic security concerns. All of that has come as a result of our friend Frank Gaffney and a coalition that he's a part of with Jim Woolsey, former director of CIA, and Newt Gingrich, and Peter Pry, and Michael Del Rosso, and a few others that have been trumpeting this vulnerability. I talk about it in the book Game Plan. This is economic warfare. Our enemies have clearly said that attacking the power grid, attacking our economic system, is their preferred methodology rather than going head-to-head against the United States military. And by doing that, they degrade our capabilities, because what happens when our economy is weakened, we decide, well, we can't fund the military, we can't afford it, and so we cut back. And that's been the doctrine. It was KGB doctrine. It's been the doctrine of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. It's written. I mean, these are published statements that's how they're going to beat us. And, in fact, that's what's going to happen if we're not adjusting on some of the things that we can do, like I identified in my book, Game Plan. Bottom line is we're in an economic war. Attacking the power grid is one way to do it, and the way we can solve that is it would take just a few billion dollars to strengthen the power grid sufficiently to withstand a natural EMP, and it might take tens of billions of dollars to shore it up sufficiently to prevent an EMP-purposed attack. But that would be far greater, better expenditure of our funds than many of the things that we've been doing in the past several years. It would be a good infrastructure project. It's shovel-ready kind of thing, and it would enhance America's national security. It's the kind of thing that as a nation, we ought to consider doing, and hopefully we've had the SHIELD Act has been put up by Congressman Trent Franks multiple times and been shot down. Hopefully we're getting enough attention to realize that our enemies have purposed to destroy us in this fashion. You know, one thing that was said is if ratepayers paid it in their electric bill, it would cost maybe just pennies a month. We've put smart meters on everything, and smart meters actually are more vulnerable to cyber attack or EMP than the non-smart, the dumb meters. But we've spent literally billions of dollars putting smart meters across the country, making us more vulnerable. If we'd spent that money instead on strengthening the security for the power grid, we'd be much better off.
Well, in your book, Game Plan, you talk a lot about what American citizens need to do to protect themselves. And I'd like to finish up today by talking about that and touching on it, because I found it fascinating. One thing that hit me and home with me is that I know a lot of people out there who are hoarding cash because they fear what's going to happen if the economy goes south. And you basically say that may not be a good idea. Why don't you tell the listeners why?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter as why money in the mattress may be a bad idea. And it's because when you're hoarding cash, you're hoarding paper, slips of paper that have a promise of the Federal Reserve on them. They don't have a promise to do anything other than the Federal Reserve says that they're legal tender for debts, public and private. If we had an attack on our currency, which is Putin has threatened, I'm going to remove the dollar as the world's reserve currency, how would he do that? Well, he'd get Saudi Arabia and China and all our trading partners to no longer accept dollars. They would ask for gold or some other form of currency when trade was conducted, which means people would no longer want to buy treasury bonds, because right now, if you want to store extra wealth, you'll buy a U.S. treasury bond if you're a foreigner. But you won't do that if people aren't accepting dollars outside the United States. What good would they do you? And so if he's able to do that, all of a sudden people will have paper that the government will have to print more and more of just to pay our $18 trillion debt. And if they're printing more and more paper, the value of it will go down. And just like in Germany, if you were in 1920s Germany and you held a lot of cash in your mattress, you found it became worthless. Or in 2008 in Zimbabwe, people who had a lot of cash in their mattress found it was worthless. So I recommend you keep some cash out of the system in case an ATM network went down, but don't put all your eggs in paper money. Have some precious metals, diversify, have real assets, maybe even have stocks and bonds are preferable to having cash. If we get into an inflation situation, all that cash is doing is losing purchasing power. And if you put it in the bank, it runs risk of being confiscated, or the bank fails and they only insure up to a certain amount, or the insurance fund runs out. All of those things suggest that you don't want to put all your eggs in a cash basket, but you need some. So I preach diversify, 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 and watch the signs of the times very closely, because you need to be flexible enough to go into gold if you have to, or stocks, or bonds, or hard assets, real estate. You've got to be able to adjust as the economic circumstances adjust. And having it all in cash makes it liquid and easy to adjust, but it also makes it more vulnerable.
What's your view of silver, for example? Would that be one of the things that people should look at to invest in?
Sure. I talk about silver. It's poor man's gold. It's nice. It's transportable. An ounce of it's around $20, so it's something you can carry in your pocket, and it's useful. The ultimate answer is something we tried in the state of Texas and probably will try again in the next legislature, where you have a sovereign entity like the state of Texas with its own gold holdings and inviting others to store gold with it, and then they keep an honest record of what gold is there, and then they give you electronic access that's highly secured to where you could go to Starbucks and you could take your Texan card. It'd be like a debit card, only it would debit 1/1,000th of an ounce of gold, which would be about $1.30 right now, and transfer it from your account to Starbucks' account. And they could either have it in the form of cash or gold held at the state of Texas. That would be an alternative monetary system that I think people could believe in. And that we suggested as a contingency plan, if the U.S. dollar were to fail, this is a smart way to create something where commerce could continue even in the wake of a collapse of the dollar.
Yeah, I've heard of that plan. I didn't know you were involved in that, but that's something that I definitely think the state of Texas ought to do. And other states ought to look at the same thing, I would think.
Well, and I've talked to other states, and they said they'd join us if we did that plan. Oklahoma has an interest, as does Utah and a few others. Texas is unique. We're about the 12th largest economy on a standalone basis in the world, ranked right up there with Spain and Mexico. So, you know, we're a pretty significant economy. And if we did it and had other states invited them to join us, I think it could be very successful.
Well, again, Kevin, I want to wrap it up here in a few minutes, but what I want you to do is tell people how they can get copies of your book. I know it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, all the book retailers, but do you have a website where they can order a signed copy from you?
Well, I don't sell signed copies, but there are some at some Barnes & Nobles where I've done book signings, like the one in Frisco and the one in Southlake locally. But you can get them off my website. If you go to secretweapon.org, you can see the reviews, book reviews by notables like former three-star general, Lieutenant General Boykin, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Woolsey, and others. You can see reviews of the book, both for Secret Weapon and Game Plan. You can access my newsroom, where you can see all the radio and television interviews I've done, which includes 700 Club and Fox and Friends and Glenn Beck and others. And you can also access my blog, which is globaleconomicwarfare.com, where I keep updates on things like what's happening in Crimea and the threats Putin's making now. So secretweapon.org is a hub, and from there you can click over to Amazon and buy the book if you'd like and find out a whole lot more information. Secretweapon.org.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's been great having you on, and I want to do this again because, there's so many questions and that I have not been covered. Things that I read in your book that I'd like to get out to the public more. And so hopefully you'll be willing to come on again sometime.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Take good care.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening in today. I appreciate you listening. And go to the USJF.net website to find out what the United States Justice Foundation is up to. And you can also go to my blog at Michael Connelly, Connelly, jigsy.com to read my latest article on the blog. It involves ATF proposed regulations. So we will be back with you again next week. And have a good week, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.